Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Back for those of you who are regular listeners to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show. I hope you enjoyed your weekend, and if you didn't enjoy it, then I hope you didn't get arrested by some black uniform wearing thug, as most of us do from time to time. My very special guest today has some very interesting, exciting and fabulous things to tell us. His name is John Bulio. Is that Dr. John Bulio by chance?
Yes, doctor. Can you hear me?
Yep, and I can hear you just fine. So why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, what I do is I work with sound and music for healing and also for performance as well. My background is I have a PhD in psychology and an MD in naturopathic. I'm licensed to practice in several states, and I've been practicing for over 40 years. And part of my career, I was the head therapist at Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital in New York City. And then I was a professor at several universities, including City University of New York. I went into private practice, and now I basically teach around the world. And I hold a professorship at California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. But mostly, I have to say, I like people, and I like doing my work.
Okay. So just like every other incredibly brilliant person that seems to have discovered something important, you have a long list of achievements that sort of, basically, it's credibility of a lifetime, isn't it?
Yes, I spent my whole life doing the work that I'm doing.
Mm. So let's get into a little bit deeper and how you first actually discovered this this new form of healing in human tuning. In fact, I have the book here for those of you who are watching on the YouTube on the delayed broadcast. The book is called Human Tuning by Dr. John Bulio, Sound Healing with Tuning Forks. So, John, if you could explain just a little bit about what this book is about and how people can kind of get a copy of it as well.
Well, first, the book I've been spending most of my life has been involved with psychology and neurobiology and sound and music. And my main interest originally was music therapy in the psychiatric hospitals. And then I spent a long time in what's called an anechoic chamber. It's a room that has no external sound, so it's completely silent inside. And I would sit there and listen to the sounds my body was making, including especially the sound of my own nervous system. And I became very interested in that sound from both an experiential perspective, we call it a phenomenological perspective, as well as from how it could be used for healing with post-traumatic stress. And so I began basically working with tuning forks to essentially change the sound of the nervous system and what I found out later was that's the way to directly go to the brainstem and release a lot of trauma that takes place for like war veterans and people who have had car accidents and so on. And then I realized that basically if I could use that for everybody, everybody has some sort of healing that they need. So I began to use it not only for special populations and hospitals, but I brought it out for the world in general. And I just called it human tuning, or tuning your nervous system to have optimal performance. And then, of course, athletes and people like that begin to get onto it. And we realized that was part of what's called being in the zone for athletes.
The zone for athletes. Could you define that? Because, of course, it's very important to in terms of the relevance nowadays with the Olympics just finished and that kind of thing.
Absolutely, because the zone really just means a place where you're tuned in. They actually use the word, I'm tuned in, and your nervous system is functioning, and you're not so caught up in external things, and you're more internal, and the pattern of what you need to do is more unconscious, and you can't be interrupted, and you just do it. They say without thinking, but there's thinking, but you're not so caught up in the thinking, and then you tend to perform better. And your nervous system basically will make the sound similar to what I use with the tuning forks.
Well, think about this. If there is it to do with mathematics? Because we had Dr. Leonard Horowitz on just the other day talking about the 528 hertz love frequency. Yep. And he says sound along with color, along with physical matter, and everything's, it's just simple mathematics when you break it down to its base pair. And you can use the right mathematical formulas through sound and things of that nature to engage the body into healing itself, that sort of thing. Is that what you're talking about to a
Absolutely.
Degree?
Absolutely. Every one of my tuning forks are based on mathematical formulas. The difference, though, is that you don't have to know the math to hear the sound. And so
you seem to be cutting out
so
there. You just seem to be cutting out there a little bit there, John.
Just playing tuning forks and they get the math fixed.
Still can't hear you. You might want to just click your Skype video off there. It seems to be interfering with the connection a little. Yeah, you're still breaking up pretty significantly. I can't make out a word you're saying. If you just turn your Skype video off, that should solve the problem. So speak again. We'll just see if you're working.
Yeah, I can speak, Vincent, but you're breaking up for me also. You're not coming through.
Okay. What about now? Just same thing?
No.
Is it fine now, or is it still choppy?
It's still choppy.
Okay, I've just turned off my video. Has that improved it?
No.
No? Okay, well, we're probably going to have to...
Wait, you're okay now.
I'm okay now?
Yeah.
All right, sweet ass. Well, that's let's hope that that has solved the problem. Just let me know if at any point that it's starting to break up again. And I'll turn off that video one more time. So apologies for that. You were starting to explain about the frequency and the mathematics behind it?
Yes, all the frequencies are mathematically based. In fact, I believe that the mathematics has a lot to do with the what's called synapses in the neural network, or synaptic junctions is the anatomical term. And those are basically ratios, or a distance between two neurons. And when the mathematics is correct, then those neurons will entrain to the mathematics. But they don't entrain intellectually, they train more. The sound gives you the mathematics through direct experience versus, in other words, I think about the mathematics, I use it in the development of tuning forks, but no one has to know that because the listener hears the mathematics and knows it intuitively.
And of course you could hear this from anywhere. You wouldn't be confined to a doctor's practice or anything of that nature, would you?
Oh, not at all. No, a doctor's practice isn't necessary. I don't even really practice that way anymore. I think you just can do it right at home. My favorite story is I was after 9-1-1. I was in the airport in New Jersey flying to Switzerland, And the customs officers pulled me over and brought me in because they had tuning forks in my backpack, and they thought they were weapons. And so I pulled out the tuning forks, and I said, here, let me show you what they do. And the customs officer said, wow, I really like that, because it's natural to him. And he called the other customs officers in, and they all listened to it. I gave them a brochure, and they became customers, and I left them some tuning forks and went off to Switzerland. But they got all the math.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could introduce some kind of tuning fork to give to TSA officers so they wouldn't want to grope young children anymore.
That's a good idea.
Quite handy, you know. Well, that's a growth industry right there. Oh, sorry, a grope industry. It's a Freudian slip. I'm sorry, I'd like to keep things on the lighter side of genocide with this particular element there. Now, speaking of which, there are those, of course, who won't believe that this is even possible. I remember my brothers, for example, a trained chiropractor, and I know a couple of trained doctors. And you know, the funny thing is about the medical establishment, it doesn't matter which field you come from, whether you're a psychiatrist, psychologist, medical doctor, chiropractor, anesthesiologist, whatever. They all have an innate ability to ignore reality, and I'm staggered at just how effective they have become at ignoring reality, and just how much research and different fields and things of that nature that they manage to deny. It's almost effortless. Is that part of the training in medical school by chance to learn how to ignore anything that isn't taught to you already by establishment pharmaceutical-funded scum?
Well, in some ways it is, because you're trained in a reductionist model of thinking. Like, you're trained to think in boxes. I mean, my whole training, I was lucky because when I did my scientific training, it was in what's called general systems science, which means the science of the whole, the integrative science. And then I did reductionist science later on the work that I do. But most medical doctors and most people are trained to think in boxes and not how to think big. And so, and also the amount of research is staggering. So you get the idea of a specialty is the idea of a box. And so it's very difficult for them to get outside of their particular boxes. I understand that. And the work that we're doing, for example, requires that one get outside of a specialty box and think in a bigger picture. But at the same time, I did all the science to integrate it into specialty boxes, meaning that if somebody's working with the heart or working with post-traumatic stress or whatever it may be, I have the molecular science to show how the sound will work in their particular field. Then it becomes a matter of that person being big enough to recognize that there are other modalities that they can integrate into what they're doing. And for a very busy doctor, someone like that, it's hard to take the time to do that. They do what they do, and they go home and they're tired or want to play golf or something. They don't care about, you know, working more.
It sounds exactly like every other working person out there. You know, you pay them a little bit or whatever so that they can go out and enjoy themselves on the weekends, but you work them so hard that they can't do anything on the weekends. They can't do anything when they get home in the afternoons because they're too tired from being a slave.
You can't imagine how hard. I mean, when I was in the medical establishment and working at Bellevue, I worked so hard. I was working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. I didn't have time to read research. I just did what I did with my patients, and that was it. So I understand from their perspective, it's very hard. Both in terms of limitations of their university training and then simultaneously the fact that they're really being asked to be codependent on a bureaucratic system that doesn't pay them right anyway. You know, even
sounds like a trauma-based mind control program to me. You get everybody incredibly tired so they can't think, just like you do in boot camp and special forces training, so that the brain no longer functions as an independent, and in fact it becomes part of the group and a silo mentality, so that they all blindly follow orders. And, essentially that's a methodology of maintaining control, and it's justified by saying we save lives by maintaining this control. But of course, the irony is military people don't get sent over places to save lives. They get sent to kill people. And their medical establishment isn't a number one lifesaver at all. In fact, statistically speaking, the American Medical Association is the number one killer in the U.S.
That's right. I think it works for emergency medicine. That's about it. Meaning that I was trained so well with psychiatric situations that if I were tired or wore out and had to talk a suicidal person off a building, I could be half asleep and do it unconsciously, then it would work. I think outside of emergency situations, it's absurd to train people that way. It just doesn't work. And so you get this unbelievable sleep deprivation and things like that. But in reality, you're trained for a very limited situation, not for the bigger picture. But I'm happy that to know that if something really bad happened, I'd probably go on automatic pilot and be able to help people. But it was a price to pay to do that.
Yeah, kind of like, I don't know, Jason Bourne or whatever. I don't know who he is, doesn't know whatever, but apparently you can just kill people with his thumb.
That's right, that's right. And I hope that I could save people with my thumb if I win it. I don't want to go the Jason Bourne way. I took a vow not to do that.
Yeah. A tracheotomy using your thumb or something. Exactly. That'd be classic.
I'm half asleep, but I did a tracheotomy. It's okay. And the person survived. I didn't remember. That would be all right.
Yeah. Well, I see that in your travels, you've managed to maintain a good, healthy sense of humor. I'm acting under the assumption, just like everybody else, really, it's essential to survive, especially if you're doing and seeing really horrible stuff.
Absolutely. I if you don't have a sense of humor, you can't. There's no way to survive it. There's no way. So I've definitely, humor and a sense of faith in human beings have got me through a lot over the years.
And that's one of the truisms I've found, particularly, as you said, in the emergency medical industry, where you see the worst of the worst, you know, the people who are, I think, who was I talking to? I think I was talking to Dr. Bill Deagle, yes. And he was commenting about on a break or something about how crude my humor was, and actually talking down to me saying how crude my humor was, actually, as in it's nowhere near as crude as us in the when we're doing surgeries and stuff like that. Some of the jokes we make are just so black, so horrific, but you can't not do it. Otherwise, all that black horror kind of gets contained within you, and when you laugh, you sort of let it out. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest Dr. John Abolio, and we will be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose that sense of humour, you'll most likely go friggin' nuts. And somebody who understands about keeping in tune and understands a little bit of humour, my very special guest, Dr. John Bolio. And if you'd like to check out his website, ladies and gentlemen, it is biosonics.com. That's biosonics.com. And there's also a sister website, biosonicthehedgehog.com. Right. And we also have other announcements today, ladies and gentlemen, before I go back to my guest. We're moving house pretty soon. I think it's the 1st of September. We have to be out now. So I'm actually going to make a plea out for the listeners, especially those living in New Zealand. We need a new place to live, and because Sarah has... you know how everything happens at the least convenient time, funnily enough? Well, Sarah's only just gone on holiday, without pay, of course, and then we hear from the landlord that we have to move out, so we don't have any money for bond or rent in advance or things of that nature. So if anybody could help out with that give us a donation at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com or gorillamedia.co.nz, it would be much, muchly appreciated. Move time's in about 2 weeks. And I think the day before moving, I'll be interviewing David Icke. and James Corbett from the Corbett Report. So that's going to be a good show for the last day in this place. Yeah, you'd definitely be tuning in for that. So if anybody can help me out, if they know somebody who has a van or a truck or owns a rental property, something, preferably in West Auckland, if you can help me out, it really, 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 it's needed right about now. So please, 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 I need your help. And I know this kind of happens a lot pretty often. I'm always asking for help. It's basically because I only ask for help when I need it, and it turns out that I need it quite regularly. All right, sorry. Back to my special guest, John Bulio. Probably, sorry about that, mate. And you can get his book at again biosonics.com. Now, John, when you came out of the medical establishment, I mean, Bellevue is actually something that I've even heard over here in New Zealand is like one of the biggest mental houses in the world, sort of thing, like the American equivalent of Bedlam. Is that right?
Yes, the oldest psychiatric hospital in America.
Okay.
The oldest hospital.
The oldest hospital, full stop.
Yeah, it period. It's the oldest hospital in all of America.
Oh, my God. Must have been an interesting place to live in. Okay. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your story and your personal life? You know, where did you grow up and what your parents did for a living? Because when it comes to activists or researchers, things of that nature, people who kind of step outside the norm, there's usually two things, the way that they get brought to it. It's either A1, they are incredibly talented and get really high up in the establishment, only to be shafted by it and then spend the rest of their life trying to make sure that kind of bad stuff doesn't happen to other people. Or two, your parents do a whole lot of different activism things, and you look back and you think, you know what, it was probably inevitable.
No, I think I took the first route. I grew up in Indiana in a basically almost a farm-type setting. I left because there was so much racism there I couldn't deal with it. But my initial degrees were taken at Purdue and Indiana University, and I came from Indiana to New York City, primarily also for the arts and the healing arts. I studied music with John Cage and people like that, and I wanted to study, be at Bellevue to do the healing arts. I ground out my career pretty much. My parents weren't college graduates. My father was an insurance man. My mother was a secretary. They loved the arts. They loved music. They loved to hear me play. And I hid my talents from all my friends because it wasn't the thing that you did growing up where I grew up at. So by the time I got to college, especially when I got to New York City, I began to flower. I really had a calling for the healing arts, and I dedicated my life to people, as well as to music. And over the years, that's all I've done. It's all I've ever wanted to do. I like to say it's my nature. So I've had to struggle and pay my dues to manifest my own nature in this world. And I'm very happy with what I do. Now I got here also because the establishment screwed me over. Meaning that I worked very hard at Bellevue. They had the city of New York had budget cuts and layoffs. They cut. I had a staff of 50 people. They cut 40 of them in 2 weeks. We had patient suicides, staff suicides. So I left. I said, "That's it. I'm going to go work for university." I went to work for university. They wouldn't give me tenure. They also screwed me over. So I said, "Enough for that. I'm now going to just build my own reality, my own private practice, my own business, and I'm not going to be dependent any longer on the system." And that's what I've done since I've been 32 years old. And I haven't looked back, except recently I took a professorship, and it was a mistake. I could call myself a professor, but I'm not interested in the bureaucracy of the university or anything like that. And thank goodness I did it part-time. But really, I'm 100% on my own. I established myself. I'm not dependent upon anybody but what I do. And I answer to the integrity of what I do to all the people I work with.
Well, how exactly did they shaft you? I mean, what actually happened to you? How did you, it's just seeing bad things happen to other people, I mean, were you involved in this sort of elaborate web network and starting to figure out that some of the people higher up were lying and starting to get kind of curious? And then it happened to me because when I was even just doing something as simple as telesales, you start to notice that the bosses are lying to you, and you start to notice that all the other employees don't actually care about the customers, or in your case, it would be the patients, that kind of thing. And it occurred to me that it wasn't just that one job that I had where I noticed that. It was every job that I ever had.
Well, in my particular case, I think that the city of New York was in a recession at the time. This was the 1977 or somewhere in there. And they were in recession, and they just decided that therapists weren't necessary in psychiatry, so they cut most of the staff. And, you know, it was a financial choice on their part. I think it was, and also what happened with my programs, because I was hired to stop what they called revolving door. So I wanted to keep people out of the hospital, so I developed community programs so they didn't have to be readmitted to the hospital, because people would be getting out, being readmitted. And what happened was my programs were so successful that the hospital needed money and the people weren't coming back. So when they cut my programs, more people flipped out and went back in the hospital. Therefore the hospital could justify its existence. And so I got to see point blank, the even at the highest level, there's this kind of like almost this people who really, they're out for their own personal gain, or they're out for the bureaucratic gain or the corporate gain. They had no sense of what they did to the patients. I mean, I saw suicide after suicide of their stupid actions. That's why I never went back to working in psychiatric hospitals, because the people who run them and the governments who oversee them, in this case is the City Hospital of New York, they don't really care. They're into some other reality as far as I'm concerned. So I said, I'm just going to establish something that I could be accountable for and live with. And because if I went back to work in a psych hospital, if I had to face any more people jumping off roofs and killing themselves because of an action that I might be involved with directly or indirectly, I don't think I could live with myself. I mean, I never lost anybody in my watch until the city did what they did. And it was quite upsetting at the time for me. I thought university would be better, like the ivory tower, but it turned out university was about the same. My class at university, so many people wanted to take my class. I had over 50 people wanted to take one of my graduate classes, and they thought something was wrong with me and got mad at me because so many people were coming to see me as a professor, and I messed up their accounting system, and so therefore they didn't want me back.
So. It's like you get punished for caring.
Well, I think that's kind of, there's that side, there's a dark side to it. I always said that if you work in a hospital, patients are easy, staff is more difficult, and the administration is very difficult. I think hospitals do good things, but I don't think anybody should really be working in one for a long period of time, because they're always doing things also that really are not. You have to be very political, I think, to want to stay in a job like that and have to fight certain battles. It just wasn't my calling to be political. It's not my thing. You know, and I'm not a good bureaucrat, so it never worked for me.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're suffering from the mental illness that I made up called employophobia, a fear of being employed by scumbags.
Exactly. I have that. It's a good phobia to have.
It really is.
I employ myself, so the only scumbag I have to answer to is me.
and my boss is a pretty nice dude as well. You know, he shouts me drinks at the end of the week and stuff like that. You know, he's me.
Exactly.
And that's the other thing. I thought it's about freedom and the choice to be able to do the right thing. When you're not the person who's the boss, the amount of freedom and the amount of choice that you have is virtually controlled by somebody else. And I didn't like that feeling, that not only did I not have control over my own life to a degree, just as you do when you're employed by somebody else, you have to be there at certain times, et cetera, and you have to do certain things when you're told to. I didn't have too much of a problem with that. It was more the fact that as soon as I got really good and started making the bosses look bad by comparison to me, that's when I was about to get fired.
Right. That's what
same
happened.
Story for everybody, same don't story. You think?
Yeah. If you're really good at what you do, it's very hard to fit in into something. Maybe there's exceptions that.
Well, there are exceptions,
maybe
but
Apple computer. I don't.
I don't know. I mean, because I've read Steve Jobs. I've read Steve Jobs' auto. You're breaking up a little bit there.
With all the academic training and everything.
Okay, John, we seem to be having some real problems with your Skype there. So I'm going. Yeah. You started breaking up basically as soon as you started speaking there. I have your phone number on hand, so I'm just going to give that to the board op, and he should be ringing you just in case the thing doesn't sort itself out. So if we just start. If you want to try and say what you said again, we'll hope the Skype has reset itself and working again. John, are you there? No, we seem to have lost him. So if the board AFI,
can you hear me?
Can,
I'm here.
Oh, wait,
can you hear
there
me?
You go. You're back.
Hello.
Yep, I've got you.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. So I'm not sure what we were saying before. We were talking about, I know we're talking about how people in establishments don't always come through the way they ought to come through, and which is true.
I think it was the last thing that we said was about how I said that as soon as you get better than your boss at your job kind of thing, that's when you get offside with them and they fire you, as opposed to saying, hey, this guy's really talented. I'm going to use him and I'm going to improve my entire business. You say, this guy's talented. He's a threat to my dominance, so I'm going to get rid of him.
That's correct. That's what happened to me exactly. But I used my talent to establish my own business, and I've been very successful. And I still am in the healing arts. I'm still doing what I was trained to do. I just do it in a way that's more better for me. And there may be other people that really the best thing for them is to work in a hospital or have a job like that. And they just that's what works for them. But for me, it doesn't work.
One of my best friends, Jono, his missus works at a hospital in Auckland here, and she comes home every now and again and tells him some stories. You know these kind of stories, like, for example, the surgeon accidentally sewed his pair of scissors inside somebody's appendix gap kind of thing. And it happens, she tells him these stories fairly regularly, and the problem is that they're all new stories and they're all really, really grisly and horrific. And yet you have a look at the media and how much of these stories that they report, and for deaths caused in a hospital kind of thing, I think in New Zealand the rate is about three times that of the road toll. Like, you're three times more likely to have your doctor accidentally or even purposely kill you than you are to die in a car crash in this country. And yet every time there's a fatal car crash, it's all over the media. Every time there's a fatal surgery. No? Anybody hear anything at all? No? No. apart from maybe the partners of the people that killed them.
Well, it's kind of a catch-22 because if you got, like, for instance, if I've seen patients that they would kill themselves, and if it weren't for the hospital, we saved them. But at the same time, I've seen patients. It's sort of like a necessary evil that we have. That's how I kind of look at it.
Yeah, indeed it is. And I was just wondering, just how necessary is evil? We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, ladies and gentlemen. It's the most necessary show in talk radio because it helps you laugh, even when we're talking about huge quantities of people being exterminated by scumbaggery film. We'll be right back after the break.
But I've never never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that I'm incredible, respectable and professional. Do you read me? Am I legible?
There's a show that's about keeping it gangster. Eventually, will the corruption in the government. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. The show that talks about shafting even more than silver mine executives. Broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave Fukushima-irradiated South Pacific three-eyed fish country. And my very special guest is Dr. John Bulio, otherwise goes as Doc from his role in Back to the Future, and his book, Human Tuning, Sound Healing with Tuning Forks. That's right. You can also heal yourself with forks as well as feeding yourself with them. Profound realization there, I'm sorry. And okay.
Vinny, don't fork around too much.
Well, apparently forking leads to spooning. Or was it spooning leads to forking? I think it was the other way around. Which is why you don't bring a knife to bed. Okay. I'm sorry. Let's start again. Can you tell us some of your experiences with the tuning forks and things of that nature and exactly what you have managed to accomplish in this number of years since you started doing all of this? Because it's all very well telling somebody what you do, but what I find is very interesting is case studies and examples of what you have done and how it's actually affected people. Could you divulge in that sense of the word?
Yeah, well, first of all, I use the tuning forks. I integrate them in with other forms of healing. So I can integrate them with psychotherapy or with different medicine type things. And that's my practice was always what I call integrative medicine. And so we use the tuning forks. You can see, especially with babies, I love when a mother comes in, she's pregnant. I play the tuning forks over the womb. The baby starts kicking. It's unbelievable how the baby begins to behave and the mother starts humming. And it's quite rewarding to see that happen. I've had war vets that I'll be doing some cranial work with, along with the tuning forks, and they start sleeping better. They start, in other words, the stress of the battle begins to leave them. The same with people who have severe car accidents. You get almost immediate results. They do it at home. They sleep better. They begin to think more clearly. Their need for opiates in the hospital, the need for painkillers and the need for opiates goes down tremendously because the sound causes your body to make its own opiates and painkillers. So it's been rewarding over the years to see people respond in so many different ways to the sound. And now it's been even more rewarding to see that the response I noticed without science, basically through practical experience, now we have the science to show why it happens and how it happens. And so now it's like the complete cycle has been made between direct experience and what exactly happens to a person physiologically when they do the sounds correctly.
And so you see. Are you able to elaborate and maybe is there a patient or something who you could point at specifically who sort of embodies part of this healing practice?
Well, I had one patient. He's a Vietnam War veteran, no legs, double amputee. He had tremendous phantom pain in his right leg. He also couldn't sleep. He was self-medicating with alcohol, which is quite common. He was would oftentimes go into shakes and anxiety attacks. And I used the tuning forks with him along with what we call body work or osteopathic manipulation, holding the head to calm down the vagus nerve. With the tuning forks and with just a minimal amount of verbal therapy, within a matter, I think about 6 weeks, he had no desire to drink. He was sleeping through the night, no problem. The anxiety attacks were cut by 2/3, and he was basically felt he was alive again. and able to relate to his wife and his family. And his wife and his family said he's like a different person. Because I think once the traumas are released from the brainstem, the whole physiology, the whole person begins to change in a very natural way. And I've seen this many times in my practice. I've also seen it when I work with pregnant mothers who are tremendously anxious. I work with them with the tuning forks, a little bit of body work or acupuncture, and they relax. If their baby's, especially a first pregnancy, if the baby is late, next thing you know, they're birthing just fine. And the baby comes out and is very happy. Everybody's happy. These are a couple of case histories. I can go on and on.
What? I think the idea is that when the body's sick or it's damaged in some way, the normal signals that get passed around by your body as to perfectly work it out sort of thing, as soon as you're damaged or have a leg cut off or have some kind of a huge trauma or something, if it's not something that's healed directly, what it does is it throws your entire body out of whack. It throws your mind out of whack. It throws your muscles out of whack and kind of destroys the signals that are supposed to be normally running. And I'm only guessing here that what those signals are is actually also being sent out to all the body by the brain as a frequency. And so hence when you use a fork, it turns the frequency back to where it should be, and the healing and what have you starts to happen all over again in a rather rapid fashion. Is that about right?
I think that's true. That's definitely a good way to look at it. The science basically is that the science we use is in neurotransmitters in the brain. But what we're really saying is if you get a trauma, if you get something that throws you out of whack, then your whole system begins to organize around that. And in order to shift it, you have to have like a lighthouse. You have to have something that guides you, and the sound will guide you. As we say earlier, mathematically, it guides you to natural ratios. It guides you to what you were before the trauma, non-verbally, without having to intellectualize anything or have a belief system. And you tend to go there automatically because it's in your nature to go there. And once you're there, your body starts to heal because it's in a good place to heal. I think it's actually quite simple, but the complexity comes in with the different stories and clinical things that you have to work with different people. But the process itself is pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way it is with people. Nobody cares how it works as long as it works.
Exactly. That's the way I look at it, too. I mean, as a doctor, I want to have the science. I want to make sure I'm accountable and I'm doing what's in the best interest of my patient. But the bottom line is for my patients, all they want is outcome. And I'm an outcome person. If it don't work, I don't want to do it. You know, I don't have time for it. I experiment with everything. And that's how I basically got onto this. I've experimented with anything, you know, and I want to see what kind of feedback my patients give me. And then I want to do the science on it, find out if I can find out more about why it's working and maybe modify it or learn how to use it better. In other words, I think the more we know about it, the better when something's working.
Exactly. Otherwise, you're just kind of taking stabs in the dark and hoping it keeps going.
Exactly. You're doing a shotgun approach or something like that, and you don't know what worked. Or my favorite is if something works for one person and it worked, then you do it in everybody, but you don't understand why it didn't work in everybody. So I'm always interested in, if something works, why did it work and who will it work with under what circumstances? That's the complexity of it. Because the science is simple, really. I mean, it's complex to read the science, but underneath of it is a simplicity. But the application of it clinically is extremely complex. That's why it takes time and a practice and working with people for lots of hours to figure it out. Because you have to modify fit that person.
I don't know. My concern is that really important information, like health information, is, I don't know, for some reason, the people who write all those textbooks and do all the speaking and everything, they can't speak English. Like, it's just this it's this convoluted sort of piling galactic garbage dump of knowledge that simply even the smartest people go, what the heck is this guy talking about?
Well, that's because they're
and you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of the freaking Catholic Church, how they had the Bibles written in Latin so nobody else could understand what the heck the priests were going on about.
That's why I don't work at university, because it's a lot of bullshit, basically.
We can't say that on air, but, you know.
You need a good shovel to work at the university. people like to have their academic towers, and I think there's something good that comes out of it. But there's also a lot of silliness that comes out of it, too. But again, I'm a nuts and bolts person. I see real patients, real students, and I want to communicate something to them that will work. I know it will work, and if it doesn't work, I want to find out a way to help it work for that person. So it's like fixing a car. You know, it's like just because you know how to put a muffler on doesn't mean that you put the muffler on the same way for every car. But the idea of a muffler is simple, you see. But you have to have a good mechanic that knows how to switch from car to car, you know.
Exactly. And also you have to have a mechanic who actually knows what he's doing. And perhaps even as a specialist in that particular area, because if you notice how there's all these different types of makes and models, and you take one car to one guy and he might know how to fix that, but then if he doesn't, he's got a mate down the road or something that might only just charge you twice the price to fix it as he normally would, because he's got a specific type of car he doesn't like, you know. And I would just find it really funny. It's like planned obsolescence mixed with science mixed with mythology. That seems to be our world nowadays, you know. There's scientific mechanisms for everything. Barely anybody knows how they work, and yet they still work. And despite the fact that they don't understand what the hell is going on in any sector of society, they're still alive, and they're still continuing to live their lives as if the world makes sense. But it's the people who are walking around carrying placards that say everything is BS and screwed up that are the sane ones. The ones who are walking around as if nothing's going on whatsoever, just having peaceful coffees at the cafe, they're the ones who are nuts. We'll be right back after the break. Alert the masses. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. I think I'm probably the only New Zealander who has an American talk radio show. That's funny. Okay, my very special guest, Dr. John Beaulieu, is here for another whole hour. And what I'd like to do, ladies and gentlemen, if any of you have some questions or what have you, I wonder if John would be willing to take some callers. What do you reckon, John? Callers? No? Yes? John, are you there? Seem to have your mute button on your Skype on there, mate. Either that or you're not actually back yet. So what we'll do then, I'll give out the call-in number, and then when he arrives back, he'll have some callers anyway. 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. So, John, I think you're back now, aren't you?
Yeah, I've been here all along. You were breaking up, so I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Yeah. I seem to have a bad relationship with Skype. We're always breaking up. Well, there's odd relationships. Okay, 218-339-8525. Ladies and gentlemen, please call in. Now, John, I prepared you for the question over the break, and I'd like to get it out of the way ASAP. It's about self-censorship. You know how we all sort of control what we say, or there's certain areas that we don't approach or go to for one reason or another, either because people might think we're a little nuts or we don't quite have the evidence to sustain what we think, sort of thing. We've got we've got a lot of theories and we've got a lot of thoughts, but not all of them are the ones that we release to people because of fears of perhaps misunderstanding or judgment. So just kind of like to offer my guests the opportunity on this show, at least, the audience that will comprehend you, because they're all pretty bright as far as I know, and the host who won't judge you, because basically I don't have the time to go around judging people. It's not worth it.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, yeah. I actually was thinking about that. The challenge for me is that I pretty much say anything in my classes and so on. I'm not part of any establishment, so I don't censor myself a whole lot. I've seen so much that I'd have no fear of, you know, anything. I'd say if you want to talk about anything, I'll talk about it with you. There's nothing I know that I really censor myself on. I could, like with the hospitals, for example, I could say I've seen the dark side of hospitals and I've seen the good side of hospitals. I just don't know where I censor myself a whole lot. I have teenage twins, twin boys. I'd like to beat the shit out of them. I mean, I certainly have yelled at them, and I'm a specialist in adolescent psychiatry, and I've completely failed. They took me through every test possible. But
it's funny how you can always solve other people's problems, but solving your own seems to be a challenge.
Yeah, but I want to say that never, ever, I don't believe in gurus. I don't believe in shit like that. I believe that everybody has a challenge in life. Everybody's got something fucked up in their life. And
we're on FCC regulated radio as well, but I don't know. Hopefully their censorship doesn't count here, but go ahead.
Everybody has something screwed up in their life. And that is, I don't care who you are, whether it's you're a doctor, whether you're a bricklayer, it does not matter. We're all in the same world. We're all facing the same kind of stuff. And we got to learn to deal with it. And so I would never make myself, you know, better or worse than anybody else. We're all in the same boat, as far as I'm concerned. I think there's a good scientific rationale for that as well. It's just that in this lifetime, my job, I got called to do what I do, and I do it. But if I was called to do something else, in fact, when I was younger, I thought I might be called to be a farmer, but it just didn't work out. I still have llamas here and stuff like that, and I still have my farm animals because I like them. But that's not my nature. But I definitely, I've seen, I don't allow myself to be caught up in the darkness too much, because I've been in situations where it's so dark that you can lose faith in life. And my preference is to always keep faith, and there's a lot of things that are screwed up, and I do my best to do what I can do, and what I can't control, I try not to think about.
It reminds me of a realization that I had not too long ago, that the term truther, for example, I don't know what other people think about the term, but for me it's just basically somebody who's a truth seeker, regardless of what your field of knowledge is, whether that be 9/11 or whether it be the medical industry. But in my opinion, anybody who is a truther, who's searching for the truth and attempting to make some kind of sense out of the world, you become damaged goods along the way somewhere. There's usually some kind of nervous tick or some other way that we kind of have to learn how to deal with it. It's like part of us gets stolen because of the lies, and we spend the rest of our lives struggling to get it back.
I don't know if I have that. I mean, basically, there's the damage part of it to me is what you learn from, and I've certainly been damaged. I told you that the system screwed me over and shafted me several times. I'm used in big ways. I mean, to the point I had to handle people dying around me and therapists dying. I mean, I've literally had to pick people dead off the sidewalk, call the police. I carried a gun for 20 years as part of my job, but I had to carry a weapon. But I think that damage is what we call post-traumatic stress. That's the trauma, but also that can be unwound. I don't think I even look for the truth anymore. I just try to deal with what's in front of me and do the best I can with it. and come to terms with it. And then the truth reveals itself. But I don't have any great philosophy in the truth. I certainly read, you know, I've studied religions, and I like the Buddha the best in a way with his Four Noble Truths. You know, life is suffering, tough shit, you know, and there's, and it's caused by attachment. If you don't like it, stop doing it. Give it up. It's pretty simple stuff when it comes down to.
Yeah, they had a friend of mine who's a big supporter of the show. In fact, he was the person who got me this this iMac that I use for the show every day. He's very much into his Zen Buddhism, and he told me this one quote that I think matches up with what you said. Was the great Buddha said, "If you have 50 loves, it means you have 50 woes, because it's your attachment to the things in your life or whatever." That is your support network. So if those people or those things that you love so much and devote yourself to disappear or are destroyed, it's simply through your devotion to them that you are the one who gets damaged and destroyed with it. So in essence, you're not supposed to have ultimate attachment to very specific things all over the place, because if you lose them, you get damaged or whatever. But instead, it's to look at everything as one, and that way you never actually lose, nor do you gain anything. Or at least that's what I got out of the conversation.
Well, I think that's true. I like, instead of the word damage, I like the word chaos. It's a scientific word. It's called order out of chaos. And system science says for any system to go into a higher state of functioning, it must first pass through a state of chaos, which means if you want to improve your life, you can only do it through getting damaged, if you look at it that way. Because when you get damaged, you have to reorganize everything. But if you let that damage run your life, that's another story. That's what's called trauma. But if you could take and make the best out of it and repattern your life because of it, then all of a sudden the very thing that was damaged becomes something that could be turned into something that was good for you. And they talk about turning poison into elixir. And there's a lot in life to poison people, but the same poison can be transformed into an elixir. The alchemists called it making transforming lead into gold. But I don't think they meant actual lead or gold. I think they meant human experience. You can transform your experience that's damaging and bad into something that can work. And that takes work to do that. And there's no easy answer, and I don't think there's any easy way out either. And if there's any way to get through life without chaos and damage, I've never met anybody in my life that didn't have chaos and damage. I mean, all the gurus I met that said they didn't have chaos and damage basically were screwing everybody around them and creating chaos and damage. So I always said, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because they had something good to teach. But they had to teach. My favorite was the Christian ministers. When I grew up, they were always doing all kinds of weird stuff. But basically, I would say, just don't make yourself perfect, and offer what you have to offer, and let somebody else judge it and work with it. That's how I do it. And if anybody ever thinks I'm perfect, they learn real quick I'm not. And I don't keep secrets from anybody, you know.
Perfection's not possible, and I've found again, back on the truth of topic, a whole lot of ones out there that basically they want to have a website, they want to have a radio show, but they don't want to even start until they've got it perfect, which is impossible. So in essence, they've made a choice to do absolutely nothing.
It's only through the chaos that you can make something work. I mean, if you don't love chaos, you're up shit creek without a paddle, is my view. You know, if you live your life afraid of getting damaged, then you're going to forget it. You're not going to be living. In fact, just give yourself a coffin and put the nails in it, you know?
Yeah. Life's a bitch, then you die. Get used to it, or something of that nature. But and again, as with every simple quote that seems really profound and whatever, it's intensely more complicated as you look more into it, and it becomes intensely more simplified the further you look away from it. And that's what I find interesting. It's kind of like one of those hologram pictures where, yeah, the further you zoom into it, the more of the same picture you see keeping on becoming being regenerated. You see the same thing the deeper you look, and the further you pull away, you see the same thing you looked at as you were looking in really deeper. Similar to microscopes and cell structures and things of that nature, the deeper you look into a blood cell, you realize that that blood cell is made up of all these others, and you look into the, all those others, you found out they're made up of all those others. So it's infinite up and down, biologically speaking. And I think it's infinitely up and down psychologically speaking as well, because for each trauma that you have, you look deeper inside it and you find that that trauma is actually the result of many other traumas. And then you have a look at the good times in your life and you look further away from them and you realize that you wouldn't have actually achieved those good times or those great realizations without those earlier traumas in your life.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
So it's all part of the one thing. It's like saying, for example, I need to have a head, arms, a body, and legs, okay, in order to be a complete man. Well, I also need one other thing, but we can't talk about that. And in order to be a complete man, that's what I need. I need all these parts. In order to be a complete man physically, intellectually, on the other hand, how does one become a complete man? Well, you need to have grown up. You need to have learned what responsibility is. And usually the only way to learn responsibility is through trauma. And, yeah. And in essence, maybe this is why the schooling system and all the other major establishments, regardless of which one it is, whether that be political or whatever, they all follow that exact same methodology of putting you through the stress and trauma of examinations and huge amounts of studies and extra responsibilities that you didn't necessarily earn. Like, I would never say that any president really earned the responsibility of being the president, just purely out of the fact that he didn't finance himself entirely.
That's right. I agree. I mean, adversity, without adversity, it's like lifting weights. You need resistance to get stronger. You know, and adversity is what if you can't achieve your life vision without having a good relationship with adversity. Nobody climbed Mount Everest by laying on their back and doing nothing. You know, you have to beat the challenge. You have to train. You have to go through some pain and learning curve. There's no other way. And anybody that wants the easy way out, they are in the wrong place. There's no easy way out.
I wound up becoming evil. And I think that's part of it, because there's a spiritual aspect to this too. I'm sure you're aware of that. A lot of people have been getting into lately, and I think a lot of the religious people, they say that basically taking the evil the easy way out is in fact taking the evil way out, and to elect suffering, trauma, not for yourself but for other people. That's the good way out, sort of thing. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I would put it that there's enough suffering in life. If you just have a vision and what you want to do and it has value to you and you move in that direction, then the adversity and the suffering that happens will be because it's for a good reason. You don't need to create it. In other words, the idea of an artist suffering, you don't have to suffer to be an artist. If your nature is to be an artist and you move in that direction, the suffering will come naturally. The adversity will come naturally, because that's part of the challenge of manifesting what you need to manifest. And it will be easy, in a sense, because you're going in a direction that you want to go. It'll be challenging because it'll be extremely personable, and you'd be very vulnerable. And somebody criticizes you, it's about something that's very dear to you, so it will hurt even more. So In my view, that would be the easiest way to live life. I don't know about religions and stuff like that, but the ultimate goal is if you contribute and you have a vision and it has value to you, there's no way. It's just because you have that, you still have to pay a price to share it with other people. And I think somehow people come in and they're suffering, and I see this all the time, and they kind of want to keep what they have, and they don't want to change. But the only way you can stop suffering is to let go of what you're suffering about. That's what the Buddha said, basically. There is a way out. Life is suffering, and suffering is caused by attachment. And if you let go of that attachment, you don't have to suffer anymore. Now, my view also is that we've got probably at least 5 to 6 billion years of attachments to let go of. So We just, in other words, it's going to be a long time, but so it's the process that counts, not so much the ideal of tomorrow I'm going to be enlightened. You know, it's enlightenment is...
It's earned over a long period of time. It doesn't just get given to you. Have you noticed that very few things in life get given to you for free that are actually valuable? If things are damaging and really bad for you, on the other hand, mate, you'll find more than you can handle. But if you want to eat something good or anything of value, it requires an awful lot of hard work or an awful lot of knowledge in order to acquire it. We'll be right back with Dr. John Bolio.
I got some so-called friends, they'll smile right to my face, all when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know.
Whose side are you on?
Are you on?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. I think it was like Wolverine who said, you know, Magneto's right, there's a war coming. Are you sure you're on the right side? And Storm says to him, at least I've chosen a side. I've chosen a side. It might not be the right one. I could be wrong. But I'd rather be wrong and do the right thing than do the wrong thing and be right. You know what I'm saying? My very special guest, Dr. John Bolio.
Bolio.
It sounds really awesome, like you're some kind of opera singer, like John Bugliosi or something like that. Maybe perhaps some kind of mafia character could be established in an upcoming film for you. But anyway, you could probably heist. Have you ever tried to heist a bank or something of that nature using your tuning force to crack the windows or break the vault open or anything like that?
No, but I saw a TV show where somebody did.
You reckon it might be possible?
Yeah, Warehouse 13, they did it.
Because it's got to be done.
Yeah.
That would be good, actually. If you and me, for example, we went down to the Fed, and we know they don't have any gold left anymore because they just gave it all to the bankers, but... Yeah, it's just like, what would be the point of even stealing from the feds? Because what are you doing? You're stealing fake money that doesn't have any value. Only to be chased by real guys with real guns to be dumped at a real prison? You know, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. People have got that whole idea that money is everything, money is what you need. And we were talking about over the break about how... some people, they get into this this game, whatever part of the game they're playing. Like, I got into the media alternative field, you got into the medical alternative field, and we've both become successful at it. And the main thing that ties us together, of course, is the trauma that we suffered both before, after, and during our wake-up and our essentially place to find our feet. Kind of like, as you say, you develop a sense of threat in your life. You know, you get thrown into the water and it's sink or swim. And it's only after being thrown in the water, only after being exposed to that real grave threat of drowning, that you actually learn to swim. And this is what a lot of new people are going through when they're getting into this, when they're trying to expose any establishment scumbaggery mechanism. You will lose money. You will lose friends. You may lose your stuff that you've spent all your years accumulating. However, that's the stuff you'll lose. The things that you will gain is you will gain people, you will gain money, and you will gain all new stuff. Okay? You have to lose everything before you gain it all back. And that's what the whole synchronicity part of actually standing in the light for the right, for the truth, brings you. Either that, or you've exposed something that's way too big and way too hot right now, and you'll wind up getting shot in the head in front of the in front of a whole bunch of people while you're cruising through some kind of Texas corridor. But, you know, that's if you happen to be a president or anything like that. But if you're an average person on the street who's just discovered something amazing, you'll be sweet, so long as you be very, very, very public about it and never worry about being assassinated, because the more you worry about it, the more likely it is to happen to you, one of my friends told me. Now, John, You've never had any fears of that nature, have you? That somebody might, you know, just go, this guy's tuning forks are real dangerous. Maybe we should do something about it.
No fears with tuning forks. only on the airplanes after 911 when they thought they were weapons. But basically, I don't have any fears with tuning forks. I've had fears in the past. I mean, I've been in situations where I've been shot at and stuff like that, but not because...
Whoa, seriously?
Yeah, seriously, yeah. Actually, that's why I say I had to go into neighborhoods with the police and help them do domestic dispute calls and develop protocols. And so I had some pretty, you know, violent situations I've been around. But that had nothing to do with tuning. In fact, if I had a tuning fork, I would have used it as a club. But I wouldn't have used it the way I use it now.
It'd be pretty funny, like bash somebody on the head, bong.
Exactly. but no, the tuning forks are very gentle and then used, and if they're used correctly, they'll really can be a very gentle reminder of something that can help your life change and keep you on track.
How in supermarkets they have speakers and they always seem to play this really feel good happy music so that you'll feel real comfortable and know the words and walk around and feel comfortable spending more money.
That music is filled with auto suggestions that allow you to spend more money and so on. I know this for a fact.
You seem to be breaking up a bit there.
It's the music, all those kind of things, or what they call black box. Can you hear me now? Are we breaking up?
I can hear you. It's just not the best, but I can make out what you're saying.
Can you hear me better now?
Beautiful, beautiful.
Okay. One of the things I did, I wrote a little pamphlet on what's called sublineal suggestion. And I can guarantee you, if you go into a store with Muzak playing, the chances are that Muzak is filled with auto suggestions to buy more and so on that you can't consciously hear, but it's embedded in the music. And it's a very big business to do this. It's really quite, there's 1,000 different ways you can do it, but it's there. You know, so again, it's somebody trying to manipulate you. And not necessarily for what would be good for you, but to manipulate you to get what they want you to do. I suppose that's my idea of evil, somebody basically wanting you to do what they want to do without any consideration for you. You know, they just want you to, like a sociopath, they all they care about is manipulating you for their own personal gain. You know, and
well, I find it'd be strange. Like, there's a lot of people who know what we know and have businesses, like organic shop owners or mechanics or even grocery store owners or clothing stores, etc. Have you ever thought about maybe doing an album with some artists and maybe a few other activists or something like that? That these sorts of people could actually play in their shops that actually does help people physically when they're just in the shop hearing this, as well as maybe might help these good people who have good businesses who actually are there to try and benefit their customers to perhaps gain more money, you know, so that we can perhaps fight more effectively a well-financed operation against the New World Order-owned conglomerates that are basically, at this point in time, lobbying government to pass all manner of restrictions so that the small businessman and entrepreneur will no longer exist.
I agree. And I put on my website a lot of free tapes people can have. You can just go there and download them. They're hypnotic tapes with all kinds of topics and suggestions. I came out with a new CD. I call it Moonzak. It's like Muzak, but it's Moonzak. And it's based on thousands of variations of Moon River. And you play it in the background when you're driving or something. And it's filled with good thoughts. I think, again, these technologies can be used to help people or they could be used to get you to buy things. I teach whole classes on the use of hypnosis and trance and music and how advertisers can use it for their benefit and how we could also use it to heal and make ourselves better. It's the technology and understanding it that makes the difference. It's the consciousness that directs it. And sometimes there's consciousness that directs it for no other purpose but for its own personal gain, and that's it. But you know, one out of every 25 people in the world is a sociopath. Do you know that?
I thought it was. Did you say 1 in 25? That makes it 4 out of every 100. Yeah, I'll say that's about right.
That's
96% non-psychopathic. But there's another element. I think there's another, like, maybe double that amount. Like maybe a 10% of the population are known as proto-psychopaths, who are these kind of sycophantic little scum that sort of follow psychopaths around and love them and lick their boots, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a. But there's the aura around the sociopath that Hollywood likes a lot. And, of course, a lot of TV shows and mobster shows are based on. But the sociopath is just someone has no empathy. They have no caring about anybody but themselves. Their life purpose is to manipulate you, to have power over you. And a sociopath becomes a psychopath when they kill somebody and murder somebody. Other than that, they're a sociopath. Majority of sociopaths aren't psychopaths. They just like to screw you over and enjoy it. And they target you to do that. And they get in businesses, or they live off women, they live off other men, whatever. And they like doing it. And that's basically it. And like I said, there's a lot of them in the world. We don't know how to treat them. There's no cure for them. There's no mental health thing to do for them. In fact, they joined my friend who was a sociopath when I was in high school, was hired in Vietnam. He was the person who killed people, who was asked to kill people. He was proud of it. He got home. He killed a lot of people at the gas station. He went to the military prison, disappeared, and I'm sure that he worked for years to kill people for the military or the government because he was good at it. Probably dead now, but because they probably eventually get sold, somebody kills them. But, you know, these kind of people exist. They're not my people I idolize, but at the same time, there's whole cultures built around them, and they have power at times.
Do you believe that they actually, like, this psychopathic elite, and it usually happens in the corporate structure, they'll advance remarkably quickly, mainly because if there's three people up for promotions, and including one psychopath, what the psychopath will do is he'll sabotage the other two people and get them fired so that he gets to the promotion.
That's correct.
And it goes like that infinitely up the ladder until you realize that if you look at Fortune 500 companies, the 1 in 25 becomes of the general population who are sociopaths. Up in the top of, upper corporate ladder, there was a great documentary called I Am Fishhead, named from the old Chinese proverb, a fish rots from the head. And they said that instead of 1 in 25, it's actually 1 in 4 when you're talking about people in an upper echelon Fortune 500 company and the likelihood of them being a psychopath, according to the psychopathic checklist of stuff that they've got there, you know, like in that movie, The Corporation.
Right.
So I was thinking about this. Society structured 100% according to the edicts and the goals of psychopaths. Think about that. You go to high school, and what high school, I believe, taught me is how to weed out people who are different, who have creativity, and more of those who have empathy, and to promote those people who are vacuous and cruel, right? Those are the popular kids, the ones who have no real value of anything that they really do. They don't care about other people. They only care about themselves and what their image is like, that kind of thing. Those are the people who go straight to the class. And also those who can't think, those who simply regurgitate, they go to the top of the class because they've got the top grades. So it's either those who don't care about others or those who cannot think for themselves become the rulers of society. They become the doctors, the lawyers, the politicians and those kind of things. And there's those two strains. One is the bureaucratic system, okay, the unthinking follow protocol, and that is the more successful branch of schooling. There's the educated ones, the ones that go real far, and the ones next to them are the talent sort of thing. Not ridiculously skilled at building things or memorizing large amounts of knowledge and may not have the best grades, but they are certainly enchanting and capable of manipulating others into doing their will, which is often very, very, it's the only skill that is a 100% prerequisite to becoming a politician isn't it?
It sure is.
All other considerations are secondary. Okay, I want to be a politician. Can you manipulate people without them having any idea that you've done it into doing your bidding? Well, yes, I can. Okay, you're in.
I tell the people that most of the people I teach with are empathetic, and I tell them the hardest thing for an empath to imagine, to even contemplate, is somebody without any empathy at all. You know, and I always say that for an empath needs to learn to be more sociopathic, but a sociopath can really, at this point, never learn to be more empathetic. In fact, sociopaths target people with empathy, and in order to not be targeted by a sociopath, you have to be sociopathic when you meet them.
Right. Or at least be aware of it, and there's a crossover here, because psychopaths and sociopaths, what they do is they monitor and observe human behavior incredibly well, and learn to mimic it so that people don't notice that they are who they are. They're incredible infiltrators in that sense of the word.
And then they ask you to do something, and you notice that's whatever they ask you to do is not quite right. There's something off in it. But all of a sudden, you're either afraid or something about they've manipulated you. You're afraid of losing them, or they started a relationship with you. So therefore, you do what they say. And in the end, they're excited that you did what they said versus that they have any feelings for you. But I work with these people in the hospital, so I know them quite well, and I know how to identify them outside the hospital. They were the hardest people to work with you can imagine, because I mean, I worked with psychopaths that were so personable, so loving.
Yeah, well, that's actually what the American Medical Journal, I read an article out of it once, says that psychopaths are really nice, lovely, and actually enchanting people when you first meet them, but don't have any long-lasting relationships and don't have any real empathy.
They're lovely.
And those are the people, and the three most likely industries you are to find them in is business, politics, and entertainment industry. We'll be right back after that. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about psychopathy and scumbaggery. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, you can tune in, and we have fabulous guests always lined up for you, both those people that you may have heard of before and people who you've never heard of that you probably might want to hear from again. And that's actually something that I have in common with the listeners, is a lack of knowledge of my guests before they come on. Larry King, I think, kind of pioneered this style of journalism, I think. Basically, to know something about the person that you're interviewing ahead of time, or more to the point, to know a lot about them, prejudices the interview to a degree, I think. And it's a lot more easy to get to know somebody if they're the ones explaining who they are, rather than you just reading their websites and doing all that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's a personal thing, a personal choice, and it might just be because I'm too lazy to do the research. But anyway, I've got a very special guest, Dr. John Bolio from biosonics.com. Welcome back. And we touched on that very, very important and a subject that interests both of us substantially, psychopaths. And, oh, my God. As I gave out that definition before we went to break, ladies and gentlemen, about somebody who's very enchanting when you first meet them or whatever, feel like you're under their spell, and then you suddenly realize that they don't really have any long-lasting relationships and they're not actually that genuine and what have you. When I first heard that, I was like, holy cow, that's like every employer I've ever had. Which just proves the point that this whole society is structured by psychopaths for psychopaths. You know, it's just that simple. To change it, on the other hand, people need to comprehend it. And the revelation that you had there, and that had never... I'd never heard that before, that they're completely incurable. As soon as you have the the sociopathic or psychopathic tendency, there's just no bringing you back to the real world sort of thing. Is it?
Not yet.
How can you determine that?
Well, you determine it by their, as you say, by their behavior, by their lack of empathetic response. You ask questions and they reply without empathy. They just don't care. Or you can see they're making something up versus they're trying to mimic empathy, but they really don't have it. Because they're great. In fact, they're unbelievable mimickers, and they know how to, as you say, observe behavior. They know how to say what you want them to say, what you want them to say, what you want them to hear. And next thing you know is once you do that, they turn it right around on you. I think I remember years ago I used to be a cult deprogrammer. You know what that is?
You get into cult members and you deprogram their brainwashing mechanisms. And you bring them back to the real world kind of thing.
Brainwashing. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do that. In the old days, we had the more what I call brutal way of doing it. We pick like the people in the Reverend Moon, the Moonies. We'd pick the kids up, throw them in the back of a van, and take them and deprogram them. They'd tell us what Reverend Moon did, and he would just basically show them what they wanted to hear and their idealism. Next thing you know, they put a picture of Reverend Moon there. Then they wouldn't let them out for a week or 2 weeks. They brainwash them. They sleep deprive them until eventually they're worshiping Reverend Moon. So we sort of would catch them and take them back to the same. It never really worked that way, but it was pretty wild. There's softer ways. There's better ways to do it than the old way. But at the same time, you were dealing with basically institutionalized sociopathic behavior in the name of religion, you know, which is pretty common too. I mean, basically, if you think about the Crusades and all the people that have been murdered in the name of religion, or the fact that these guys could fly airplanes into the trade centers just because they believe. I mean, I keep thinking what kind of a religious sociopath could have detonated an atomic bomb in New York City? You know, it's like, who knows?
Well, I think Satanists who have control of the city, for example, might have the tendency to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, but what I keep, as a psychologist, I keep thinking, what kind of consciousness could detonate an atomic bomb? You know, it's just that's what interests me. I've studied this.
I don't know. What about the Aztecs, for example? I think there was like this one ceremony where they're cutting out people's beating hearts and cutting off their heads, stuff like that. And they sacrifice 80,000 people in one ceremony. So yeah, this consciousness thing that we're talking about has existed for a very long time, and it has not been able to be eradicated from the human condition yet.
It's very much there. It's basically a form of black magic. Again, it's something that sooner or later in my field that I've had to deal with and come face to face with. I mean, I work with SS officers in Germany. I've worked with people who've killed many, many people, serial killers and so on. It's one thing to talk about, another thing to actually meet the people and talk with them and interview them. And they're all personable. I like every one of them. That's the thing. I'm going, God, this guy's like my father, but if you close your eyes, they would stab you and walk away and eat their dinner. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's very difficult for us.
It's a predatory thing, isn't it?
They're predators. They stalk. They're like tracking you. They mimic your, I watch my kitty out chasing the birds, and the cat mimics, will sit there forever and move with the bird or mimic, and then eventually they kill the bird. There's people that are predators. As an empath, I'm an empathetic person. I've learned how to be predatory. And that, like you say, in terms of developing your own business and stuff, you have to be predatory. You know, there's no other way to do it. You have to but you can't let it run your life. You know, you can't let it take you over, but it's something that you have to learn how to do.
And more to the point, it's something you have to learn how to spot in your competition. One of the things is it's about the element of surprise, don't you think? Because if you're aware that somebody's a psychopath, you know that they'll try and screw you over first chance they get, and so ergo you can avoid or perhaps engage in some traps for them or record your conversations with them. That's that sort of thing in order to derail them, because predators and murderers and things of that nature, they do get caught, but it's the fact that they're so skilled at hiding who they truly are that makes it so difficult to catch them in reality.
But once you become aware of them, you learn how to walk away. You know, that's the only way you can deal with them is just to walk. If there's something they know they can't get from you, they'll go get it from somebody else. You know, and but it's a matter of how do you learn to identify those behaviors, because they come on. Like I said, they're really, really nice, sweet people. It's true. I mean, when I worked my first did my residency, I had to work with this guy. He was a criminal sexual psychopath, and he was on the ward, and he convinced me I should let him out because he was such a nice guy, and I did. And he stole the credit cards of the head doctor, took off to Mexico, spent probably racked up $5,000-$6,000, which was a lot of money in like 40 years ago in credit card bills. They catch him, bring him back to the hospital. And I asked him, I said, why did you do that? He said, because I liked you, John. You're such a nice guy. I thought I'd just take the credit card and have a good time. He had no sense of what I went through. He didn't care. And then the head psychiatrist, to his credit, because he's made my mentor, he says, now do you understand what a sociopath and psychopath is? And I said, only had I seen it face to face like that could I ever really know it. Because it's almost impossible for an empath to comprehend that it could exist.
You know what? That's exactly right. And when anybody talks about the New World Order conspiracy and the whole global control, world governance, that kind of thing scenario, the first thing that often people will say is, oh, why would anybody do that? I can't understand. You know, and I'm saying to people, look, yes, it's not comprehensible. You know why? Because you're not a psychopath. If you were, this whole system wouldn't be confusing to you. It would make absolute sense.
Well, because they can... sociopaths do things because they can do it and they like to get away with it, and that's it. There's no other reason. They enjoy the manipulation. They have no love. They have no empathy. They don't get any value the way that someone with empathy would get value. I always thought if a lot more empaths could learn how to be more sociopathic, it'd be a better world. You know, rather than let the sociopaths control them. But that's a real challenge. I actually teach empaths how to be more sociopathic.
It's about losing your innocence, I think, because if you're innocent, you're unaware of threats that might exist.
Oh, you better believe it. You have to lose in a way. I always say I was so happy early in my career. I got to work in the bowels of these psychiatric hospitals because I lost my innocence real quick. But I kept my faith and I didn't lose my empathy. But I certainly learned. And I learned from training with the police. I learned from all these different things how to be basically more predatory and more blunt. It's not New Age. I don't care. And that New Age stuff is limited. One has to be both protected and empathetic at the same time. It's a real challenge. I have, you know, especially for a healer. I mean, I can't imagine a greater challenge for a healer. And for me, all the time, it's a challenge because I want to help everybody. You know, and if I saw a sociopath, that I just walk away and I wouldn't help them because they couldn't be helped. You know, and that's the hardest thing in the world for me to do. But I wouldn't encourage their behavior, and I help people that have been targeted by sociopaths, I help them understand. But like you said, they're everywhere. It sits around, you know.
It is around. So be aware, ladies and gentlemen, if you've seen anybody who's really, really, really enchanting, who makes you like them really instantly, but they haven't actually done anything nice for you, and in fact they've got a record of being a real scumbag, they're probably a psychopath who's going to turn you, the empath, into their nice little smorgasbord, aren't they? What they'll do, because they're a dining predator, ladies and gentlemen, and we, the empaths, the people who actually care about other people, we're the buffet. So thank you, John, for coming on the show, what's your website again? Biosonics.com. Great book here, Human Tuning by Dr. John Bulio. Get it now, and we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.